previously on Unsolved. In March 1998, Father Alfred Kuntz bled to death in the hallway of St. Michael's School in Dane, Wisconsin. Someone slit his throat.
There were so many possibilities for who would want him dead. I mean, he rubbed many, many people the wrong way.
The message of Father Alcuin is one that not everybody wanted to hear.
He was polarizing. People that that liked Father Kuntz and liked the church were all in, and those that weren't were all out.
From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved, Season 3, The Devil You Know. I'm Gina Barton. The night before he was murdered, Father Kuntz recorded several episodes of a radio show. It was called Our Catholic Family. It was co-hosted by Peter Kelly. And that night, Father Kuntz's best friend, Father Charles Fiore, joined them. Peter Kelly told me that Father Kuntz had recommended that Father Fiore take over the radio show. It wasn't that Father Kuntz didn't like doing the show. It was just that he was really, really busy. And he thought Father Fiore was a man after his own heart. He could get across the same message, but he was a lot less busy. The difference in the amount of free time the two priests had came through even when Kelly was talking with them on the phone.
When I'm talking to Father Kuntz, trying to set up a radio program or whatever, I had an agenda list, bing, bing, bing. And then I knew when Father Kuntz was ready for the conversation to be over because he'd say, "Okay, Peter," which means hang up the phone, I got stuff to do. It was hard to get Father Fiore off the phone and don't mention Italian cooking to him because now you're going to be on for another hour as he talked about how his mother would make this or that or the other thing.
The other big difference between these two priests was that Father Kuntz didn't care about money at all and Father Fiore was actually pretty rich. He lived in a huge house on top of a hill that he called Monte Cristo. Here's Chuck Nolan, who used to be a reporter in Madison, talking about how Father Fiore made his money.
It was a company called Fiore Oil and Gas or Coal and Gas or something like that. And I had understood that his link to that family business had made him quite wealthy. We called him the millionaire priest. It's very anti-Kuntzian because Kuntz was a guy that almost worshipped poverty. You know what I mean? He wore it on his sleeve and he used it in his work.
On the night of March 3rd, 1998, Father Fiore took over the microphone for the first time. Peter Kelly says he was natural, which you can hear in this clip.
Parables. Now, what is a parable? It's nothing but a tale. The kingdom of God is like a man who goes out into the field, like. Mm-hmm. It's a simile, a metaphor, mm-hmm. who goes out into the field to sow his crops. And now we do it with machinery. Now we have the plants to put the tobacco into the ground and the corn into the ground and into the furrows and so forth. Then it was scattered mm-hmm. by hand. And he said some of it falls on good ground, some of it falls on rocky ground and the birds of the air come and eat it up, some of it falls on infertile ground and dies.
And the farmers listening are nodding their heads because they've done all of that.
They understand better than I. So this is how he was teaching in these simple ways. But he was telling a story always for a purpose. This is the way the kingdom of God is.
After Father Kuntz's murder, Kelly put together a tribute show to honor him. And on that show, Kelly talked about that night, which turned out to be the last time he ever saw Father Kuntz alive. The show was broadcast on Easter Sunday, 1998.
At approximately 8:40 p.m. on Tuesday, March 3rd, 1998, Father Alfred Kuntz, Father Charles Fiore, and your host, Peter B. Kelly, completed a taping session for the Our Catholic Family radio broadcast at the studios of WEKZ in Monroe, Wisconsin.
Most of the time, the Our Catholic Family show didn't have music in the background, but for the tribute, Peter Kelly put some in.
The two priests prepared to leave the station that night. I advised that we had enough taped programs to bring us through Palm Sunday, April 5th, 1998. Then, completely in jest, I teased Father Kuntz that for the following Easter Sunday, for today. I was planning a special holiday program just about his life and ministry. Picking up on the jesting, Father Quinn's dear friend, Father Fiore, hastened to add that we will call this program about Father Quinn's From Rags to Rags. We all laughed, particularly Father Kunz, because we all know Father Kunz was never, and would never be, rewarded on this earth for the countless loving sacrifices that encompassed his entire priesthood. That laughter of Father Kunz was the last sound I recalled hearing from my good friend. He then stepped out the front door of the radio station, and within a few short hours, he stepped into eternity before the God he always served.
Unfortunately, I couldn't talk to Father Fiore. He died of natural causes in 2003, 5 years after Father Kuntz was murdered. But Chuck Nolan talked to him not long after that night at the radio station.
Well, during the taping earlier, before they were on their way home, both he and Peter Kelly, who produced the show, noticed that Kuntz seemed preoccupied a lot during that final broadcast. Really preoccupied. And there were also rumors that a lot of people knew that Kuntz felt his life was in danger.
From the radio station, it was about a 70-mile trip to St. Michael's School in Dane. Father Kuntz had a little apartment that was actually inside the school building. Father Fiore was driving, and Father Kuntz was in the passenger seat of the SUV.
You know, it's late at night, dark, early March. And we've all been there, you know, Wisconsinites. We've been driving at night when it's just this fine line between, you know, rain and snow, you know. And Fiore says all of a sudden it got really quiet, you know, in the car. And I turned to Al and said, you know, Al, you've been a really good friend. I really do love you. And then he said he looked at Kuntz and he saw his face illuminated by the dashboard lights, and he could see the tears were streaming down Kuntz's face. And Kuhn says, I know, I know. That's the last he saw him, alive.
The Dane County Sheriff's Department pieced together a picture of what happened after that. Lieutenant Kerry Porter told me Father Kuhn spent a couple minutes on the phone with another priest around 10:30 p.m. Lieutenant Porter wouldn't tell me that other priest's name, and he wouldn't share the details of the conversation. But he did say this.
Their conversation was quick and businesslike. There was nothing in the conversation that would suggest that he was fearful or that there was a big event about to happen.
The police believe Father Kuntz was killed not long after that call ended. Dawn Johnson and her partner were the first detectives to be put in charge of the case. I spoke with her on her front porch over the summer.
It's nighttime, he's in his t-shirt with his belt unbuckled, he's got his pants and shoes on, he's got his monster ring of keys in his hand. He's getting ready for bed. He's already undone his pants. Why does he step out of his apartment? The radio in his apartment was like on full blast. He's hard of hearing, so it's really loud. So the fact that he's stepping out in the hallway, where is he going and what is he doing? I personally think he was just blindsided. He was going out in the hallway to either lock something up or check something out, or he heard a noise.
So how did the killer get into the building? Lieutenant Porter tells me that's an open question.
There's marks on the door. There's certainly disputes between whether that's a pry mark or whether it's wear. No obvious signs of forced entry. That would be obvious that, yes, this was something that was broken into.
So does that mean that he let somebody in, or that he left the door open, or that somebody was already in there when he came in? Or
that we don't know.
From the condition of his body, the police believe Father Kuntz fought back. Here's Sheriff Dave Mahoney.
There's indications on his body that, you know, there was a struggle. He was a Golden Glove boxer, and he was in excellent shape for his age. So we believe that he probably got some good blows off, punches to the offender, because there were indications, you know, to his hands that he had been in a pretty good fight.
We know that there was a fight. and the exchanges were low, and there was injuries on Father Kuhn's hand that would be consistent with striking somebody. So we believe that, yes, there was a struggle that occurred beforehand. The other thing we believe is that at some point during the struggle, Father Kuhn's went down to his knees, and that the perpetrator slit his throat from there.
So what did the police find when they got to the school that morning? That's after the break.
Hi, I'm Allie, and I work with Gina and the Unsolved crew here at the Journal Sentinel. Support for this episode comes from Casper. You spend a third of your life sleeping, so you should be comfortable. The experts at Casper work tirelessly to make a quality sleep surface that cradles your natural geometry in all the right places. The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amounts of both sink and bounce. Casper delivers right to your door. Gina's 10-year-old son helped unwrap the box, and he found it pretty amazing.
Oh my gosh, look!
Whoa! That's actually crazy.
You can also be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. If you're not completely satisfied, they offer hassle-free returns. Shipping and returns are free in the U.S. and Canada. You can get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/UN and using promo code UN. Terms and conditions apply. That's casper.com/UN, promo code UN.
Don Johnson and Dave Catnaugh, who was a patrol officer, were among the first cops on the scene. I talked with Don about this during a follow-up interview in her office. Quick warning, their descriptions may be disturbing to people who don't work in law enforcement.
The blood from that man stretched from one side of the hallway to the other side of the hallway, locker to locker, with him in the pool of it.
Deputy Catnaugh told me when he was first dispatched, he had no idea what he was about to walk into.
They didn't come in, as I recall, as a report of a homicide or someone dead. It seems to me it came in as someone injured. Okay. And, I don't want to speculate on what the nature of the injury was, but it just seems to me it was an injury, and maybe there was some fall involved and some bleeding.
He tells me he didn't think the call was anything other than routine. Once he walked into the school, of course, that changed.
And certainly just a glance when I got closer at the extent of his neck injury would have been enough to positively determine this individual was deceased. The extent of his injuries were such that I don't think it's probably news to anyone who's read reports or conducted any research that the father was almost decapitated. To me, that just speaks of somebody who was very angry.
In any murder investigation, the first thing the police try to do is put together a timeline of how the victim spent his last 48 hours. Did he argue with anyone? Did he meet with anyone? Did he say anything strange? In this case, the police heard about a couple of interesting things that happened during that time. Carrie Porter, the lieutenant of detectives, remembers one of them.
There was one, and I don't recall the name of the person that he had told, that was adamant that he had like a very worried look on his face and said something about pray for me. And I think it was pray for me exactly, but didn't inquire further about what that was about. So that would be something that we would definitely want to know. But the person that he told this to had said that the look on his face was concerned.
Don Johnson, who was the lead investigator on the case for the first 2 years, recalled something else.
You know, one of the things that haunted this case is on the morning of the murder, he received a phone call at the school that we were not able to trace. And it was an upsetting phone call where Quinn's was perturbed with whoever he was talking to. And we were never able to trace that call back then. But that really bothered us because we felt like maybe that call was the precursor to whatever that person came back and did that night. But we didn't track it, couldn't track it.
Remember, this was 1998, so they just didn't have the technology back then. Gwen Rupert, who's the lead detective on the case today, tells me they would have used Father Kuntz's old-fashioned paper Rolodex. They would have called everyone in there and asked them if they had spoken with Father Kuntz that morning. But the first cops on the scene made a mistake. They let the school principal, Maureen O'Leary, take the Rolodex, and they never got it back.
You know, who knew in the first 2 days this was going to become such the whodunit that it became? But yeah, she should have never released those things.
Okay.
Ever. Or at least not, like the Rolodex, we'll get a copy and give it back to you. And it got released and we never saw it again. And especially, again, in the day of no cell phone, that was his contacts, his friends, his whoever.
About the only call the police could track back then was the 911 call. The person who made that call was a teacher at St. Michael. His name was Brian Jackson. At the time, he was 24. The sheriff's department wouldn't give me the tape of the 911 call or the transcript of it. They also wouldn't give me any additional police reports. Because it's an open case, they don't have to, under the Wisconsin Public Records Law. Luckily, some of those police reports my editor found in his desk document what Brian Jackson said about the morning of March 4th, 1998. According to the police reports, Brian Jackson got to the school around 7 o'clock that morning. He said he was usually the first person to get to school, and that day was no different. He said when he looked through the two sets of glass doors that led into the building, he saw a pool of liquid. It looked black. Someone was lying face down in this black pool. At first, he thought it was one of the students. But when he got closer, he realized it was Father Kuntz. He dropped his bags, threw off his coat and sweater, and ran over there. He felt for a pulse, and he thought there was a faint throbbing in Father Kuntz's neck. Then he ran to the school office and called 911.
911, what's the address of your emergency?
The dispatcher asked him a bunch of questions, like whether he could tell if Father Kuntz was alive, if he had a pulse, where he was bleeding from. Every time, Jackson would drop the phone and run back to the body. In the crime scene pictures, you can see the phone off the hook, with the cord stretching out the door of the office and down the hall as far as it would go. The dispatcher told him to roll the body over and try to start CPR. Jackson told the police at that point, he ran back to the body, grabbed Kuntz by the shoulders, and turned him over. He could see blood on the priest's stomach and may have put his hand there to check what was wrong. Then he saw Father Kuntz's neck. He told the police he shook Father Kuntz's arms, quote, to get him alive. The police reports I saw only list some of the exact quotes from the 911 call. The thing that strikes me the most about them is that Brian Jackson is dropping F-bombs left and right. That tells me he must have been really panicked. People who worked at St. Michael were not in the habit of cursing because it violated one of the Ten Commandments. In a follow-up interview with Dawn Johnson, I asked her about that 911 call, which she's heard several times. She said anyone who listened to the recording would be able to hear how freaked out Brian Jackson was.
I think all you're going to hear, though, is the high-pitched, oh, no, you know, when he starts going like that, when he's, I think, flips Kuntz's head or whatever and sees with a mess. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that you're going to be startled, is that how his voice just completely changes to this little girl. You can tell the stress level was off the charts.
Wayne Honer, another detective who worked on the case, has also heard the 911 call multiple times. Remember, Brian Jackson was just 24 when he made that call.
Brian Jackson on the 911 call sounded generally freaked out. He was upset. He was following the lead of the dispatcher, because I don't think that he would have been able to function on his own without somebody telling him to do a certain task. With the degree of injury that Father Kuntz had sustained, I think anybody with any experience at all would look at Father Coons, probably even from a distance of 5 feet, and say, there is no hope to be able to do anything here.
Since the Sheriff's Department won't release the audio recording of the 911 call, I've asked a narrator from our newsroom to read some of Jackson's statements for you. At one point, he said this.
There's so much fucking blood. I have no idea where it's coming from.
After he turned over the body in an attempt to start CPR, he said this.
Oh my God, somebody slit his fucking throat. I think somebody murdered him.
At one point, he also made a statement that some of the detectives found really strange.
I suppose I'm a suspect.
Brian Jackson turned out to be right about that. I'll tell you why after the break.
Hi, it's Allie again. Support for this episode comes from HelloFresh. If one of your New Year's resolutions is to cook more and eat out less, HelloFresh can help you make those goals a reality. Every week, they deliver an insulated box full of pre-measured ingredients right to your door, along with easy-to-follow recipe cards. They do all the planning, shopping, and prepping, which makes it easy to prepare home-cooked meals. Each one takes a maximum of 30 minutes. I often come home from work tired and hungry with no idea what to make for dinner. Sometimes I get started on a recipe and then realize halfway through I'm missing one of the ingredients. Neither of those things happened when we tried HelloFresh. All the ingredients for pineapple poblano beef tacos were there waiting when I got home from work, including fresh limes and peppers and cilantro. Take advantage of HelloFresh's special offer for 2019. Get $80 off your first month by going to HelloFresh.com/UN80 and entering promo code UN80. That's HelloFresh.com/UN80, promo code UN80.
By the time Deputy Catnaugh rolled up, Brian Jackson was standing in the church parking lot.
As I recall, he had on, like, dark pants and a white shirt, and there was blood on him, quite a lot of blood. It's my recollection that he was very agitated. And you know, that isn't something that you would not expect to see. I mean, anybody outside of law enforcement, experienced law enforcement, who came upon that kind of a scene is going to be greatly affected.
Later that morning, Peter Kelly got a call from Father Fiore.
So Father Charles Fiore asked me, Peter, are you sitting down? And I said, yes, Father, I'm sitting in my office chair. And then he told me that Father Kuntz was found dead in his school that morning.
So he rushed out of work and he headed for St. Michael. By the time he got to Dane, a bunch of people who knew Father Kuntz were gathered at the town hall across the street from the church. They had to stand in the municipal garage because there were too many people to fit in the town hall building.
Well, we just stood and wondered what had happened in this teeny little town of Dane, Wisconsin. Can't imagine why this would have happened. Who would have done this? Why would this happen in this small burg? I mean, Dane is really a crossroads. We were just, all there were questions. Nobody had any answers. We were praying. I don't know how many rosaries were said in that garage. Talking to each other. What did you know? I don't know much more than you know. How could this have happened? What was going on?
There isn't a sheriff station in Dane, so the detectives brought Brian Jackson to the fire station to ask him some questions. He admitted he and Father Kuntz had their differences. Peter Kelly sums up their issues this way.
I don't think Father Kuntz and Brian Jackson got along well. I think Father Kuntz expected a lot of a young man. He expected behavior to be very much restrained. You're supposed to know your place and do your job.
As photographer Mark Hoffman and I stood on Dawn Johnson's porch that day last summer, she told us she could see why the female teachers would find Brian Jackson distracting. I start laughing here because I'm surprised. I have never heard a cop say anything quite like this.
Ryan's a good-looking man.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a hunk of burning love.
Oh, okay.
Any girl that's not married that's working around him, you want a piece of that.
I see.
Very good-looking man.
Hunk of burning love.
Oh, my God, he was a beautiful man. Beautiful body. I mean, he was just a really... He didn't belong there. You know what I mean? He didn't fit in at all.
Peter Kelly says Jackson used his looks to his advantage.
I know Father Kunz once described the teacher, Brian Jackson, as a hall monitor, which is something less than a teacher. I understand that Brian Jackson was a bit like a little rooster in a hen house there, surrounded by females, female teachers, and was a distraction, I think, for some of the single women who were there. I do know that Mr. Jackson allowed some of the female, single female teachers to buy him things, which I think wouldn't set right with Father Kunz. He didn't like the socializing, male, female, among staff. It frustrated Father Kunz enormously, and I think if he didn't have that need for that one other individual in the classroom, he would have been fired a long time ago. If another teacher, male or female, but I'm sure Father Kunz would have preferred female, had come and say, yeah, I'll teach for you, Father. I think Brian Jackson would have been gone in a heartbeat.
Now remember, the new DNA they found in 2012 doesn't match Brian Jackson. And Sheriff Dave Mahoney told me one of the reasons he thinks the case hasn't been solved is that some of the detectives over the years were so focused on Brian Jackson, they may have overlooked other suspects and other clues.
And I think we kind of got tunnel vision in the beginning of this case and concentrated too much on him. Multiple leads start pointing to that individual, and then I think you kind of build up within yourself this perception that this is the person, and we need to prove that that's the person. Instead of keeping that very open mind that look at the facts and only the facts.
The sheriff told me one of the reasons they looked at him so closely was the fact that he reported finding the body.
Statistics show that the person who makes the 911 call can very well turn out to be your primary suspect. And it's particularly interesting that he found the body, makes the call, and has all these confrontations with Father Kunz previously. So there's no doubt that he had a burning difference with Father Kunz.
And with that, Brian Jackson became a murder suspect. But he was just one of many. Next time on Unsolved.
But I was getting more nervous and more nervous, and I would pray. And the night of, I felt like I had to do something. So I packed up the kids, dressed them up, I got dressed up, and then all of a sudden I had a vision that there would be impending doom.
Unsolved is reported, written, and produced by me, Gina Barton. Our sound engineer and videographer is Bill Schultz. Photographer, Mark Hoffman. Artist, Lou Saldivar. Web designers, Aaron Coy and Andrew Malika. Our editor of local news and investigations is Greg Borowski. Our copy editor is Debbie Davis. Our theme music this season was composed by Evan Johnson. I also want to thank Donna Billmeyer, Miles Moffitt, Ashley Lutheran, Meg Jones, Tom Ketting, Rachel Piper, Emily Risto, Anissa Johnson, Rick Wood, Brian Kranz, Joe Hanneman, Elena Weissman, and Taylor Palmby for their help this season. More information, along with photos and video, can be found on our website at jsonline.com/unsolved. And please support local journalism. You can subscribe to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel at jsonline.com/deal. Thank you.